From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. One of the biggest challenges with building housing that people can afford is the high cost of land. The Spokane Land Bank buys parcels and holds them to sell to developers who are building affordable housing projects. We'll talk with Amy Manning from the Land Bank. We'll talk with Emma Epperly from Idaho Ed News about how schools and politics have become intertwined in Kootenai County. And a Spokane County guardianship program is celebrating 25 years of protecting vulnerable people and their financial affairs. We'll talk with Superior Court Judge Rochelle Anderson about the history and mission of the program. That's today's Inland Journal from SBR News. One of the most important parts of building affordable housing is acquiring land for free or for a reasonable price. It's one of the biggest challenges for organizations that are looking to build housing for people who can't afford market-rate homes. Recently, I read an article in the Journal of Business about an entity known as a land bank. So we brought in Amy Manning, the executive director of the Spokane Regional Land Bank, to talk about how they work.
Well, first of all, I think I need to say lots of folks can land bank, but land banks are a specific structure that is kind of a quasi-governmental structure that allows land to be held tax-free usually for the purpose of community good. So rather than having land or properties go to the highest bidder, it goes to the highest good. In our case, like, we really focus on affordable housing is our mission. So the land bank that comes into the Spokane Land Bank is for affordable housing development. Across the country, there are more than 200 land banks, and they have been put into effect to focus on vacant, abandoned, and dilapidated properties. In Washington State, we are adding underutilized. We really feel like there's land that government folks are holding and for-profit folks are holding speculatively that could go into the land bank to help us address the crisis.
So where does the land bank get money to buy land?
That's a great question. So currently, right now, well, we had three properties and we just sold one. Right now, we're very new, like 2 years old, so just a toddler in the scheme of things. And so right now, we've been using grants and the sale of our properties to be able to, like, purchase land, but we haven't yet. The idea that we've taken to Olympia and that others are supportive of is that we have a state or city or county-backed land acquisition fund that would help us pull in land that maybe nonprofits around don't have that capacity to pull it in. So we would pull it in, hold it for a time, and then get it into affordable housing. So the idea would be we would have that low interest, like, state-backed fund that we'd be able to do that. And that would be part of the land acquisition, and it would seed itself because it would be a revolving loan fund or grants. But it would seed itself as we get property into the land bank. Those sales and that sort of thing will help fund the next acquisition.
So does the land bank just hold the land? Does it improve the land in any way? For example, if you bought land and there's some remediation that needed to be done?
Yeah, part of what we're doing in Spokane is we are the first nonprofit to receive a EPA brownfield grant, assessment grant. And so we got that by focusing on three invested formerly redlined neighborhoods, West Central, East Central, and Hilliard. And we are working with the EPA to identify land that could be developed into affordable housing that might be a brownfield. We work with Department of Ecology and other folks to, when we find a brownfield, to figure out what that remediation is and help get the funding so that it can get. So yes, the answer is yes. I just wanted to make sure that folks know that that is part of how we're funding the work right now, is through that grant and trying to identify, and also phase one environmental assessments and phase two environmental assessments cost money for affordable housing developers, and every little bit, it's such a thin margin for folks to get that housing out there, that the more we can take off by holding land and keeping the cost down by performing those assessments means that more housing gets built. We will, and land banks across the country do improve land. They parcel it out. They work on brownfields. They do some creative ways to pull property that has been sitting and causing challenges to neighborhoods into development or into like an asset, not just affordable housing across the nation, but like daycares and, you know, art consortiums or community gardens, lots of different things land banks work with. But ours is particularly focused, as it was born in the low-income housing consortium, on affordable housing.
So you mentioned about 200 land banks across the nation.
Yeah.
Are land banks very established in Washington?
No. So we are the only little rogue land bank in Washington. There are a couple of folks that are, you know, kind of coming alongside us or even ahead of us. The Tacoma Development, it's not Tacoma, it's Pierce County Community Development Corporation, is doing a lot of amazing things. And they do have that land acquisition fund and are pulling parcels in and have been doing this development hand in hand with a, like a similar group that works in Tacoma. But we are the only officially unofficial land bank in Washington state. We don't actually have the legislation to be able to scale the work that we're doing right now. So right now we're figuring out how to do it at a small scale in our community through that brownfield grant, through donated properties for mission-aligned folks, and through working with a group that is doing church land bank development called Liminal Lands.
So if there's a company, an individual that says, I've got a parcel of land, I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Can they just sell it to you? Can they give it to you? How does the process work?
Yeah. So they can give me a call and we have a kind of an assessment tool that we would go through to make sure that the land that we're bringing in would be developable. We've had a couple of kind of swampy areas that would not be something that we could develop, but the land that is currently in the land bank was donated just like what you said. So some of that was donated like just a pure donation, and some of it was sold at a reduced cost. The property that we closed on in East Central was a nonprofit Spirit Community program, and it was closing. They had been in business for like 50 years and things had changed, and their partnership, their ministries just were not, they didn't have the same volunteer group and supporter. So they had decided to close. And in that closing, they really wanted the property to keep a mission going and be part of the neighborhood in a meaningful way. So that's when they contacted the land bank to get that property. So we did purchase that, and half of the purchase price went to support mission community outreach of the price. And then the other went to the land bank, and then we sold it to Take Up the Cause, which is a small developer in Spokane that is working on Black homeownership Spokane. So those are the things that we like to see, is like a lot of different community members kind of coming together to improve the neighborhood.
So you've alluded to this, but you went to Olympia last week. You testified before a House committee.
Yes.
Tell me what you're asking for.
We were really just presenting about land banks and co-ownership models. And really, I think they were taking the time to look at some different things that are bubbling up, different ways to think about housing, all the way from what we're doing to co-ownership in taking on trailer parks to like have a co-ownership model in those, and then from AARP to be doing like kind of a service model where folks are AARP and another, I don't remember the last one, but just a lot of different like models that we can do. So what I presented on was really what land banks can do and like what we would need to do as we really start to make some inroads in this affordable housing crisis. We were asking for to hold the land tax exempt, like while it's in the land bank, to be able to clear titles. It's really, I think I said this at the thing, it's very unsexy work what land banks do, and affordable housing development is, you know, like housing development is pretty unsexy as it is. So these things are very kind of wonky, but like they will help keep the land at a low price for affordable housing developers. So one of the things that we're asking is that the state really allow for housing authorities, nonprofits, or public development agencies to be able to apply to be land banks, and that we would have one per county. So this would be a really coordinated effort, because while everybody can land bank, and that this doesn't take away from that, Habitat for Humanity can land bank, Catholic Charities can land bank, Community Frameworks, all of these folks that are already doing good work can continue to hold their properties for development. But what this allows us to do is for our local community to have a plan and a pipeline for development, and to take those things and hold them so that, you know, there are times where we see properties that we could get in the land bank, but nobody can move on them fast enough. And so they end up being kind of flipped in a sort of, what is the saying, lipstick on a pig? Like, they kind of paint the outside and then like get it out and jack up the prices in the neighborhood. So those properties we could potentially get into the land bank. I think the last piece of it is for transfers of tax delinquent property. We are asking for this, and this is sort of a long shot, but the first right of refusal on tax delinquent properties that the county brings in. Washington State doesn't have a lot of those. We have a really long foreclosure process. So like by the time, it's usually around 3 years, those come in. They're usually pretty challenged properties. And so being able to potentially pull those in to the land bank for development too.
So as we get deeper into the affordable housing thing, mm-hmm. and we say, what are some of the other remedies that we haven't really thought about? Do you think land banks are one of those things that is going to be really a growth mode sort of thing?
I think that it's kind of an all hands on deck. And you'll hear this, I think, from a lot of affordable housing folks, is that this is a 50-year crisis of underinvestment. HUD budgets in the 1980s were cut by, I think it's like 82%. And so investment in affordable housing, underinvestment in affordable housing has been happening since the late 1970s and the 80s. So like, this is not an overnight fix, and land banks certainly are not that, but it's a tool. It's a tool that our community can use that can resist speculation. I live in West Central. The house next to me was vacant for almost 40 years. And the person who owned it was in the neighborhood, but they didn't want to sell it until they could get a certain amount. It wasn't tax delinquent, but it had a lot of like other like issues, things like that. Like, I think the land bank can be an option for folks in that, to help us move forward, and to like have a lot of folks, a lot of smaller developers have a hard time doing affordable housing development, have a hard time finding land that they can sort of cut their teeth on in affordable housing development. I think the land bank, the way that we're visioning it, could help in that a lot. So there's a number of things that I think land banks can help with. One is creating a workforce, a local workforce, for small infill development. Also, they can address small infill development and keep it affordable.
Amy Manning is the executive director of the Spokane Regional Land Bank. In North Idaho, public schools and politics are becoming more intertwined. Idaho Ed News reporter Emma Epperly has recently written about that dynamic. She joins me in the studio to talk about it. You tell the story through the eyes of a woman in North Idaho in Kootenai County who is a homeschooling mother and is also a public school advocate. So tell me about how you hooked up with her.
Yeah, so Suzanne Gallis has really transformed over the last few years from homeschooling her 7 children to putting them in a mix of public and charter schools, and then becoming a fierce advocate for public school, for the Lakeland School District. And so Suzanne, a few years ago, founded the Friends of Lakeland PAC after Lakeland School District's levy failed. And she has such a strong connection to the district, in part because she really found community there. One of her daughters, Dorothy, really struggled with an eating disorder and eventually died by suicide. And, you know, some of the first people at Suzanne's house were school administrators who had been so supportive during Dorothy's treatment and through this whole ordeal. And there was a huge funeral, a big service at the school that Dorothy's classmates wanted to put on. And so just this connection to community really grew out of that tragedy. And so from there, then she got involved in the Booster Club. And then someone told Suzanne, something's going on with the school board. Will you look into it? And from there, the whole thing just kind of snowballed into her founding the Friends of Lakeland PAC, Political Action Committee, and then becoming involved in helping to find and coach school board candidates.
One of the early scenes in your story talks about how she's essentially putting information out there and she's expecting to hear back from some of her compatriots who are homeschooling families, and mm-hmm. she's not finding the support she thought she was going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, you know, the story really details this saga with Lakeland that dates back to a failed levy, which levies in Idaho are a huge deal. And so there was a failed levy and then they passed the levy. They've had another failed levy last year. And so Suzanne has been campaigning and she's been hearing from people. Oh, I didn't realize how important levies were to the school district. I didn't realize we'd have to pay $1,600 to put our kids in sports if the levy failed. Oh, I didn't realize how much influence the school board had over these different issues. Like we talk about in the story, the school board in Lakeland has instituted a pretty intense review process for materials used in schools, which resulted in one instance, the drama class had to have study hall for 5 weeks because the Brothers Grimm Spectaculathon play that the drama teacher Allison Knoll wanted to put on wasn't approved by the school board. And she touts herself as, you know, one of the most conservative drama teachers in North Idaho. And she couldn't get approval. It took 5 weeks. And kids just sitting there. So, you know, Suzanne has been talking to all of these parents and to other people in the community. And they all are so surprised to be hearing all these things. And they're showing up to vote, right? They don't want to have to pay for their kid to play sports. They don't want to lose access to these classes that are really valuable, like the drama class. And so they're showing up for these levy elections. Voter turnout's growing. And then it comes to these trustee elections last month, and nobody's responding. And, you know, the trustees are who decide if the levy gets on the ballot. They're who create this curriculum review process. They have a lot of power in the school district, especially in Lakeland. And so Suzanne was really hoping that the candidates that she had been supporting and coaching would win. And she just wasn't getting response from those same people who turned out for the levy vote.
Hmm. So what's the cautionary tale here?
The story really is Suzanne on one side and then the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee, the KCRCC, on the other side. And they instituted about, so like 2020, 2021, what they call a rating and vetting process for candidates from, you know, the water sewer district all the way up to mayor for all of Kootenai County. And this rating and vetting process takes place in the basement of the Altar Church. We talked to the pastor, Tim Remington, and they ask candidates a slate of questions. And those questions don't necessarily have to do with this specific race. So we talked to all the candidates for this trustee election. And one of them talked about how, you know, she didn't really want political endorsements, but she wanted to meet this group. They're powerful in the county. And one of the first questions they asked her was about how she feels about gay marriage. And she's just thinking, you know, what does this have to do with school board? How is this going to impact my daily life as a trustee? And so these KCRCC candidates that are rated and vetted and selected by the KCRCC are who won this cycle. And the KCRCC puts out this red card that has all the candidates that they've endorsed. And a lot of people we talk to out on election day are just saying, you know, I just take the card and I just vote for who they recommend. And even one of the candidates, Jeffrey Broadhead, he said, you know, I wouldn't have a campaign if I didn't have this KCRCC endorsement. And so I think it's really about who is selecting these candidates and who is voting. I mean, these races don't get a ton of turnout. And so I think the story really is about who is selecting these candidates for school board. And so we've got this kind of political machine on one side, and then we've got this former homeschooling mom on the other side who's, you know, doing community outreach. And who's selecting these candidates? You know, everybody in their story is a Republican. And so I think that's kind of another interesting piece, is this divide within the Republican Party.
Is Lakeland the only school district in North Idaho that's battling this?
No. So there are three pretty large school districts in Kootenai County. There's Post Falls, Coeur d'Alene, and then Lakeland up in Rathdrum. And they've all dealt with this to some degree. Coeur d'Alene also had a failed levy and has had some controversy on their school board. A candidate endorsed by the KCRCC resigned after a DUI incident in over Easter weekend last year. And so there's some interesting tension in all of the trustee races, in all of these school boards over, you know, KCRCC endorsed candidates versus not. I think it's important to note that, you know, not every, there's a different level of adherence to the KCRCC's platform amongst their candidates. So you mentioned in Lakeland, there's a 4-1 kind of ultra conservative versus more moderate split. But that more moderate trustee was also endorsed by the KCRCC. So I think it's interesting that it also does depend on the individual person and their approach to the position.
Emma Epperly is a reporter for Idaho Ed News. You can read her story at idahoednews.org. Not long ago, people associated with Spokane County's guardianship monitoring program, including Superior Court Judge Rochelle Anderson, came to the courthouse to celebrate the program's 25th year anniversary.
The guardianship monitoring program is designed to help the judges keep oversight on the cases. We have about 2,200 people who are subject to either guardianship or conservatorship or both, and that means that 2,200 people in Spokane have been determined to not be able to make decisions for themselves, whether it be decisions about where they're living or their medical decisions or financial decisions. So they are subject to court orders that have assigned a person to make the decisions for them. The GMP is the program that we've come up with to help the judges keep oversight on those 2,200 cases.
In the late 1990s, the Washington legislature mandated counties do more to oversee the affairs of people like this. Now retired Superior Court Judge Kathleen O'Connor says it didn't tell them how to do it.
The legislature put the onus on the county to supervise these types of programs. And how much money do you think they gave us?
None.
Zero. And so the fact that we weren't doing it was pretty typical of all the other counties in the state of Washington. Nobody's doing it.
Rochelle Anderson says Spokane County's program is mostly volunteer-driven. There are two staff members and judges like her who oversee it, but it's mostly volunteers who review files and documents for those 2,200 individual cases.
What do volunteers do in terms of audits?
So once a year, the conservator is supposed to fill out a report that explains how they've spent the money on behalf of the incapacitated person for the year. So they will have, it's like a checkbook, you know, they will have a form they fill out that explains any money that came in during the year and what sources it came from, and then where monies were spent. And they're supposed to keep them under categories, so medical expenses, living expenses, other, and then they also have to have their supporting documents, sort of the checks and balances. So the bank statements will come in as well, and the volunteer auditors will compare monies in and monies out, and it needs to balance at the end of the year. So they will look at whether or not it balances, and then they also take a look at some of the things that the money's being spent for, because that's another thing you don't want somebody to get taken advantage of. Maybe they can say, we've spent $600 at the casino, but I'm not sure that that person should have $600 spent at the casino. So they look a little deeper into the types of monies that are being spent.
You have five volunteers for 2,200 cases.
Yes.
How do you pull that off?
It's a challenge, for sure. We have systems, I think, that are really good as far as keeping track of when those reports are due. They're not all due at once. It's staggered throughout the year. So every month, our GMP staff has a computer program that lets them know which cases are up for auditing that month. So we have them come in bits. You know, people bring their reports in, and our five auditors work pretty hard. We also have from time to time had to tap into some other resources. We have another current court commissioner who has a background as a CPA. So occasionally we will pull her in to do some audits. And we also had, starting about 4 years ago, a partnership with Eastern Washington University. I didn't mention that yet, but we have coupled with some of their master's level accounting programs, and they will have students that come in and do auditing for us a quarter at a time. It's not, you know, long term, obviously, but they will come in for the quarter and we train them on what they're looking for. And we have certain types of cases that we have them do for us, not the really high amount estates, but they will come in, and so they get credits at school for doing this volunteer work and learning the field. And we get a pretty robust group every few months that comes in to kind of give us a boost to our volunteers.
So when you look for volunteers, what are the things you're looking for in a particular volunteer? What specific experience?
Not necessarily. We do like people that have a background of some sort in finance. So whether that be that they are in a former career that they did something with finance, or whether they just understand the keys to balancing a checkbook. It's interesting, the college students, I think today they don't have that same background. I learned it in high school. We had to learn these things. But really attention to detail, so somebody who could understand a balance sheet, has the ability to process the ins and the outs, and has an eye towards what we're looking for with taking advantage of a vulnerable person. So, and commitment. It's going to be, you know, a time commitment. We ask that they put in at least 6 months if they devote time to doing this. But other than that, just a passion for wanting to help. In addition to our volunteers, and we have the folks that are, you know, subject to the guardianship or conservatorship, we also have the folks that serve as professional guardians and conservators, and a lot of them are attorneys. And then we also have the folks that do the initial investigation to determine and recommend to the court whether this person needs to have a guardianship. Those are court visitors. And I'm really involved in that, involved in recruiting our court visitors, training them every year. And it's a great group of professionals that really we're all in it to help people. You don't do this kind of work if you want to be rich. You do it because you care about, you know, your grandma that you knew that got dementia in her older age, and you really remember how you wanted to make sure nobody was taking advantage of her. Or you do it because your, you know, best friend has an adult child who's living with Down syndrome. So it's just, I think the folks that I've met through the whole system, we support each other. We recognize it's hard work, but it's really rewarding knowing that you're helping people. And we all could look at our lives and know somebody who has probably needed this kind of help at some point.
Rochelle Anderson is a Spokane County Superior Court judge who is part of the county's guardianship monitoring program. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at Spokane Public Radio. Hear it on the radio every Thursday at 12:30 and Saturday at 2:30, and online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. That's also where you can find the SPR News Now podcast, which is published every weekday morning. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Thank you for listening.